I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy.
Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I'm your host, Yannick, and on today's episode, we are talking about the day in the life of educational psychologists. So I've got two amazing guests with me today, and I'll allow them to introduce themselves.
Hello, everyone. My name's Jason. I'm an educational child and community psychologist. I'm also a proud father of three, and I'm a professional academic tutor as well at a university.
Okay, great.
Hi, everyone. My name's Shyla, and I'm a child and educational psychologist, newly qualified in my first year of practice.
Great stuff, great stuff. But you're both doctors, right?
Yeah, that too.
So why do you lead with that? No, let's do that again. We're going to introduce it. But you need to big yourself up. If I was doing that, I would have said Dr. Yannick.
We could say that.
Yeah, so
there's a reason behind it. There's a context around how the word is used, the title is used, and I think that's a part of the interesting conversation as well.
Oh, is there?
I would say so from my perspective. I think
okay, let's start with that. I didn't know that. And it seems like I'm interested to know what your
I guess my take on it is that yeah, we are doctors. It's the highest level of academia you can study at. It's a really massive achievement. But often that title can be something that gets in the way, sadly, when you're working in certain community groups. So, yeah, I'm always tentative where and when I use it. Mm. I was really proud to be, you know, given that qualification and achieve that level. Yeah. But at the same time, I recognize that actually some of the times I just want to relate to someone who I'm speaking to. So the titles don't really need to be put in there.
Oh, so you feel like the title hinders you a bit, or people get a bit fearful of... And do you mean like... Is it when you're working with like families and children, or more with like professionals?
Yeah, I think both actually. Like families and children, like they hear doctor, they think medical doctor. They think someone who's going to prescribe something.
I think in the industry,
in the profession, there's a lot of emphasis on where you sit with that expert model, that whole white coat model of doctor, where you're saying, this is what you need. I've told you what you need. I've got the knowledge. So we try and edge away from that quite a lot in terms of thinking about collaboratively building up ideas about what you need. You're an expert, I'm an expert in different ways. Yeah. So if I lead with a doctor, sometimes it can immediately put me into this one-up power position that I don't necessarily want to be seen as when I'm trying to connect with someone who's, you know, 3-4 years old. Or a parent who doesn't speak English, or for whatever reason, there's a dynamic that I could create by introducing myself as Dr. Jason. Yeah. Shyla, I know that's just me.
Dr. Shyla, what are your thoughts?
I think it's, for me, it was an interesting one because when I was studying, I didn't actually realise until partway through my first year that as part of all of the hard work that we do get this doctorate title. So that wasn't something that was in my periphery at all. And then towards the end, I was like, I'm going to say it loud and proud wherever, whatever opportunity I get because of how much it took to get the title. Mm. I find that it's very, like Jason's saying, like it depends on what situation you're in when you may use it. And I know that it's on my email signature, but I wouldn't necessarily walk into a room and say to a parent that I'm Dr. Shyla, but my friends and family will address me by doctor.
Is it on the postal letters as well? Do you get?
Oh, yeah.
It's on the postal letters?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, I've changed
change
it on.
Your driver license as well?
Not that bit yet. I'm graduating later this year, so when all of that.
Is it on your driver license?
It had to be, yeah.
Oh, wow.
When I qualified, I was super excited. I'm not going to lie. It was everywhere. At my wedding, it was Dr. and Mrs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we represented hard, and I feel like that was important because it's not often seen. When I see other young trainee doctors or junior doctors, I celebrate them highly because black particularly.
Yeah.
I celebrate them highly because it's not often seen. So I think it's a double-edged sword.
That's amazing. And it's great that we sort of kicked on with that. And I wanted to ask you, what inspired you guys to be or to want to be educational psychologists? Because the reason I ask is... There was a point in my life as well that I wanted to be.
Mm.
And still can.
An educational psychologist. I feel it was because of my sort of expertise and experience like within education, background in like psychology and whatever else. And I thought that the two just meshed together and it just sort of made sense, and I also wanted that doctor title. I can't lie, the doctor title was just, you know, was just like just itching at me. But what was it that inspired you guys to take that step? Is that something that you realized later on in your careers, or is that something you knew from when you started university? Because I think often when you're doing like A-levels or thinking about university, etc., and the opportunities that are about in terms of careers, not that many careers sort of highlight the different expertise within their field. So if you speak to someone and just said, oh, I want to be a lawyer, what type of lawyer do you want to be? Like international, criminal, environmental lawyer? Or if you want to be a psychologist, what type of psychologist? Like clinical education, etc. But even education psychology, I only realized or it only came to my attention later on. I didn't know about educational psychologists when I was at uni. I didn't even know it was, you know, a thing. So what inspired you guys to want to be educational psychologists?
Yeah. Do you want to say?
Yeah, I can. So I'd say for me, I'd always have had a curiosity in how the brain works and in child development. I've always had a love for learning. So when I did my undergrad in psychology, I thought, okay, I've come out and I'm going to be a teacher because that's one of the professions that I knew a lot about. But with like my own research, I found that there are so many different careers that you can, as you said, Yannick, like integrate like your love for teaching with your, like my passion for psychology and just like thinking about human behavior, unpicking human behavior and wanting to work with the younger generations, because I have a lot of belief in how malleable they are and how things like the importance of play can be great for development. So I was trying to find like a middle ground for all my different interests. And I did think about pursuing clinical psychology, but there was some narratives at the time that were like, you know, it's really competitive. But I find that any doctorate or any psychologist, you know, career you're going to pursue is going to be competitive. So it took me 3 rounds of applications to get onto the doctorate course. And I also didn't know that there was an educational psychologist. I remember like going online and looking at the different types of psychologists and then also completing like a survey to find out how my own skills matched the different types of psychologists. That makes sense. Yeah.
So 3 rounds over what period? Like how often could you apply? And when you say 3 rounds, essentially you're saying that the first time you was unsuccessful, the second time you was unsuccessful, and the third time you were successful.
Yeah.
What made you, even after the first time, say, you know what, I'm going to try this? Even after the second time, say, you know what, I'm going to try this again?
Well, if I work backwards, like the third time was kind of an accident, but I guess everything's meant
to everything. The third time?
Yeah, it was
the time that you were successful.
The time that I was successful, wow. I wasn't intending to get on with the same intensity that I had in previous years. It was the year of COVID, and I just remember saying to myself, I've got more time on my hands, why not put another application in? I haven't got anything to lose. And I'm very big on like feedback. So the process that you go through in order to go on to this doctorate, In the second attempt, I got to the interview stage. And when you have the different types of interview, you have like a solo interview, you have a group interview, and you have a written task, and then you get like a RAG rating. So the director of the course at the time would contacted me back and said, like, this is how we found you in these different areas. So I took that feedback and I studied it, and I went to like better myself, and I came back knowing what I knew from the time before, but also with a new experience that I had gathered from my current employment at the time. So I'm a big believer in, if at first you don't succeed, you keep trying. And I didn't have anything to lose, and I knew how passionate I was about trying to create change and be a representation in a community that's not necessarily, you see a lot of people that would look like me being of service to children and families. So
that's amazing. Thank you. How about for you, Jason? What sort of inspired you?
Yeah, I guess it's funny, we're talking about like doctor and what it means in different communities. Like, my dad's Nigerian, my mom's from Barbados. So like, yeah, we joke about, you know, in particular West African households, you can either be a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer, right? Those are the options. And funnily enough, me and my brother, we just kind of, we fell into, he went the law route and I went the doctor route. But them times, all I knew was doctor equals GP or medical.
Mm.
And so whilst I was blessed to be academically gifted, like I did all right in school, primary and secondary, it lent me to thinking about, oh, well, what can this take me? Like my mum was always big on education, given me choice, didn't want me to be a delinquent. She'd heard that word from older generations and didn't want to associate with her two boys that she was raising. So there was a lot of emphasis on do good in school, like do well, you have to, it will give you options. And she's right, like I can't deny it for myself and for many others, school is a good option, like the academic route. But yeah, I always had in my head about, oh, work hard, you can achieve this level. And everyone knows doctors have status, like as you say, it's kind of known, isn't it? Is there a doctor in the building, like that kind of level? So I kind of started with that and then I was like, well, actually, I failed science at college. I didn't do well in chemistry, but I did do psychology because when I went to the open, they interested me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, what's this thing? And the teacher was cool, Marcel, shout out Marcel. And yeah, she put me on, like she just made me think about like, what is psychology? The study of what? Like me, us, everyone? Like that was a deep level thought for me that I hadn't even considered could be in my like repertoire, like something I would participate in and take seriously. Fast forward to uni, I picked psychology and I did it as undergrad. And those times, there wasn't really a focus on careers yet. Only to the third year, there was talk about clinical. It was the big, shiny, do clinical, you get this much pay. It was the main one that people were pushed toward. But most people who were going to be psychologists were going to pursue clinical.
Mm-hmm.
Educational barely got a mention. And I thought that was really interesting because often people look at clinical and educational almost like clinical is adult psychology and educational is child. Now, at the time, I had lots of interest in working with adults, doing sessional work like a therapist. You sit down in a session and you work in that regard. However, clinical is extremely competitive to get on. And after, I'm going to be real, 10 years of applying, I hadn't got anywhere. I made maybe 8 applications across those 10 years. I got to interview stage twice and been rejected. And I heard that the average is 7. So I was like, oh, I'm doing worse than the average. Like, what's wrong with me? Them times I couldn't afford a master's. I couldn't afford postgraduate qualifications. I had a 2-1 at uni. But in my mind, I wanted to really pursue this career. I saw the doctorate, which you get paid to do. Just put that out there. Not many places in the world where you get paid to become a doctor. Like most US courses, you're in debt at the end of it. Significant debt. So it is a massively competitive, massive opportunity. And so when I explored it for myself, clinical seemed like a dead end, but I had got close. But then educational became this thing. I was like, oh, maybe I should consider that. So I started to do work more with children and young people. And I remember there was a pivotal point for me because I was working in what was a mental health crisis house for adults. And an 18-year-old came in. And I was like, oh, you shouldn't be here. Like, what's going on? You're really young. How can you have a mental health crisis already? And to the point where if it wasn't the house that we were working in, like a residential space, it would have been an inpatient admission, you know, where you're locked in and forced, not always, but at times force-fed medication for your benefit, like is the argument. So I was like confused about this 18-year-old having lost hope with society already, really depleted, really depressed. Acute psychiatric illnesses. And I was like, how can this be in such a young age? And I became more interested in that, did some work with children's charities. And I just realized like, that's where my energy should go.
Yeah.
Like for me, the hope is with the younger generation, like not to write off anybody, but just recognizing where I felt my energy to be most helpfully applied. And so at that point, I switched over to not just applying for clinical, but also applying for educational. You get like 4 per it's annual, the application stage, and you get like 4 or 5 per year. So after 2 years of educational psychology and having that pivot in my focus, I managed to get onto the course.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a long journey, but we got there.
That's amazing. And you spoke about the pay as well. And one of the things that I think I struggled with when I was thinking about the ed psych pay, because it's how many years is the course?
It's 3.
3-year course, 5-year commitment at the time when we were studying.
That's right.
Yeah. So you'd study for 3 years and then you'd have to do your service for 2 years.
The yearly bursary is about When I last checked, I think when I was thinking about applying maybe like 2 years ago, was it 17?
Mm.
So about 17,000?
So it climbs each year. But yeah, I think last time I checked as well, it was like 16 or 17 for the first year.
You can't live on that, man.
And
it goes up in your second and third year to about, I think around 19. Including
going up from 17, unless you're doubling, tripling, and I think that's one of the things that sort of made me think, like, you know what, I can't do it. If you're, especially in adulthood, if you've got children or if you've got a mortgage or rent or, you can't do it. And I wonder if, and it may not be the case, but I wonder if there are others who, are in a sort of similar mindset to me where they wanted to do it, but then the bursary, was something that, you know, sort of held them back. And for you guys, I know you both studied at different times, but do you feel that the bursary was sufficient? If not, did you have to work part-time or for like additional funding? And if you did have to work part-time, did that then impact your commitment to study as well? So how was that for you guys?
I think finance is definitely like a barrier to some people even pursuing the course, as you say, and even people that were on the course at the time. There was a lot of like, and still is, campaigning around trying to advocate for more money to be able to study. Even people that were going into the course maybe financially more stable, life situations happened where that changed, and then they might have been like the main earner in the household, for example, so they were going through a lot of difficulty. I found I had to make sacrifices. I might have been one of the more fortunate people in terms of like I don't have dependents, and there is the advice is given that you don't take out, like, you don't stay in employment or you don't take out a job, or you have to make a commitment because of how much you have to commit to the course. So I found myself trying to do 0-hour contracts, trying to juggle where I could. But as you said, it would have a knock-on effect on your actual work or the energy and the time that you have for your work. There are things such as like hardship funds that are available through universities. But again, that's even like another kind of loophole you have to find yourself having to jump through and having to prove yourself in order to obtain like additional support. And I would say that the universities, well, I feel like my university at the time was very aware of the impact that the finances were having on people and were trying to be part of the campaign for raising more money. I just have to say, I think it's a sacrifice. It's a sacrifice that one has to make, like almost like feeling like you have to go back in order to go forward.
Yeah.
Because as you know, once you qualify, then you are able to begin earning more money, better money, and increment that over time as you gain experience.
Mm-hmm. I would jump on what you're saying, Shaila, because I think absolutely, like you spoke about, what is the salary post qualifying, and it is a not quite tripling of the bursary. Like it's a fair chunk jump back to where perhaps you feel like you should be at that stage in your life. But yeah, likewise, I had to make sacrifices as well. I had luckily the blessings of supportive parents. Like they took me in. I had to sell my property that I had a mortgage on so I could make ends meet while I was studying. I knew that it wouldn't sustain my outgoings at the point of the stage of life that I was in. I also had a dependent. I had a young daughter at the time. So for me, there were lots of things I had to consider about, is this going to be beneficial in the long run? Mm. And yeah, financially, people want to make money. They want to get ahead in life, but I get that. But I also, you know, when you pick psychology, I don't think everyone's picking it for the money. Like, it's not one of those careers where, like, you're looking at the paycheck at the end of the day only. I think there's so much for most people, I would guess, about job satisfaction and appreciation for how you get to serve the community or a group of people in a way that others don't, and the skill set that you get to learn in the process of that. So it's a juggling act of, like, I'm going to be satisfied or even thrive in this job, do well, feel like I'm living through my passions and through my truth, but the salary for 3 years isn't going to be where it should be. My peers will probably be laughing at how much money, you know what I mean? Mm. It's not quite, you're not on the same trajectory as your colleagues and peers. Mm. So there is something to be said about making peace with that.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, I think it's a difficult one, but as you said, Shiloh, as well, you know, there is campaigning for that. So hopefully that's something that, you know, progresses throughout the year so that it's not, you know, a barrier for anyone who wants to access or wants to be, you know, part of this field. So I wanted to find out from you guys as well, what does a day in the life of an educational, you know, psychologist look like? I know ed psychs work across schools, they work across like the communities, etc. But I'm also conscious of the fact that even within schools, if a class teacher is not sort of directly working with an educational psychologist, you can just have educational psychologists coming in and out of schools, and class teachers have no idea what's going on. They just know someone's coming in to do an observation on little Billy, and that's it. But they don't know what's happening after that. Sometimes they're not even, you know, part of those conversations because it's for SLT and the heads of year and the safeguarding needs and whatever else. And you mentioned earlier, Jason, as well, that sometimes when people hear educational psychologists or see doctors at the front, they think it's all around, you know, administering medication or whatever else. So even for families, so for those in the audience, whether they're families, whether they're teachers or whoever else, and they don't have an idea of, you know, what an educational psychologist is and what an educational psychologist does, what is your day-to-day life in terms of its site, because it could be different for others.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think maybe we'll start with the five core tenets of what an educational psychologist does, so everyone gets it's the baseline, really. So CATER, so consultation, assessment, intervention, training and research. Every educational psychologist has done that or should be doing something like that in their general practice. The research element is not so often part of everyone's kind of remit, but what that can look like is lots of things. So we will work with ages from 0 to 25.
Zero?
Yeah, so babies, fresh out. More so with that work will probably be parental support. So you're giving parents advice about newborns and those kind of things. Your children's centres, you'll visit there to support them. Yeah.
What advice are you giving to a parent for a newborn that their GP or doctor wouldn't?
It's a good question. So like it could be a range of things. Like some parents may be unaware of, I'm trying to think about, I don't do that young work. So I'm wondering, Shiloh, if you've got a better answer than I could offer.
I would add that, like, if you think about children are learning from the get-go. So from newborn, we're all social beings, human beings, looking for, let's say, from a newborn, their work is to interact, learn how to interact. So it could be something as simple as developing eye contact or knowing how to interact with your child. And for some newborn children, there are situations where they're born with a condition in which you would know they may have learnt difficulties with their learning. So that might be where they're on our radar. So even if we're not necessarily that there, you know, at the moment of birth, they may be referred to somewhere like a children's centre for under fives and have multidisciplinary professionals involved, and we might be one of them. So one of the things I do my day to day to answer one of your questions is I drop into children's centre stay and play sessions where parents will attend with their children, and I will kind of provide ad hoc advice. It might be that I'm interacting with the child, we're playing, and the parent asks me a question, or the children's centre staff have a query or a concern and they want me to just spend a little bit more time with that parent on a bit more of an accessible basis, not something that has to be too formal. It could be around sleep, it could be around talking, it could be around, you know, the way that they play or how they interact with their siblings. There's so many different aspects.
That's amazing, because I've been working with ed psychs for years and I didn't
know it was that young.
Yeah, I didn't know it was that young. I thought it was from like reception moving forward.
Yeah. I'm thinking about one of the interventions that we do where I work is called VIG, so Video Interactive Guidance. And one of the aims of that is to support attunement in a relationship. So imagine a parent who's struggled to connect with their baby from birth. It could be postnatal depression. It could be other things that have gotten in the way. Imagine migrating from a war-torn country. Like, we work with all different types of communities. So in that regard, there is an expectation that some professionals will support that parent to understand the concepts of attunement. That is knowing what your baby needs and how you can meet those needs. And so that work will center around parental support, doing micro videos to try and help them with many pieces of advice about, look, that's what we're looking for, you're doing it, and supporting them to feel validated and acknowledged in what it means to be a parent effectively. So yeah, it hasn't got to be grand, big pieces of work. It can just be little things that support the building of a relationship where parents have already struggled and they're finding it hard. But yeah, we 0 to 25, and that 25 was extended not long ago to consider like university and other students who aren't getting support.
So it wasn't 25 before?
No, it wasn't.
What was the threshold?
It was 18 before.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, yeah, to answer your question, the day in the life could look like visiting multiple schools. So you might do consultations with various staff members, separately or jointly with family members as well. Heads of year, the SENCO is a key person. So that's the SEND coordinator, if anyone doesn't know. A key person who EPs have relationships with in schools, whose job it is to coordinate the provisions of care for any students with SEND, with special educational needs. And yeah, all of that work is part of your daily timetable. So you might do those things, as well as definitely there's an aspect of report writing. So a lot of our work is evidenced in how we can demonstrate strengths and needs of a young person in the context of their learning environment. And then we would formulate that into kind of like a few paragraphs to explain what we think is the underlying concern. And then we might add some outcomes or provision. So that's like things like, we hope the child will achieve this by this point. Smart targets, if you will. And the basis of that is to help people to have something to reference when, as you say, teachers might not even see the EP sometimes, which is really unfortunate. And that needs to change, because teachers have got an amazing grasp on what the child needs. And often we're trying to elevate them and their profile so that they feel empowered to speak on what they know of the child in partnership with us, in collaboration. So I say all of that to say that, ultimately, we're going into schools to help make change and affect change in different ways, from assessment to consultation to intervention and definitely training as well. And yeah, I think the other point quickly I'll make is that it works from the individual level. So you might work with one child one-to-one. You might do groups or class level interventions where you're thinking about what's the most effective way for me to get this intervention to reach a lot of young people. And then also systemic work, which people often forget, which is thinking about, what does this school need? What does the system around this child need? How can we affect change in that level and build lasting, like a legacy of change that feels like it's got deeper potential to make that change like last for longer.
And would you say like anything in your day-to-day sort of differs from that?
No.
Considering you're sort of newly qualified. So from, when did you qualify?
Yeah, so what were you now?
2025.
Oh, that's crazy. 2021. 4 years I've been qualified.
Yeah. And you're how many months?
I've finished in summer of 2024, started work in September 2024.
So about four. So he's like 5 years, you're 5 months.
If you take away the placement when you're studying, because you're also working in a way when you're studying. I was going to add that I think one thing that not many people maybe know about the role of day in a life, which is not always so structured and planned, is that as educational psychologists, we also provide support for critical incidents, and that is at, you could say it, at a systemic level, like at a wider level. And that critical incident is basically something that is quite sudden and sometimes fatal that can affect a whole school community. So for example, it might be the death of a child, the passing of a member of staff, an incident that's happened right outside a school setting that many people have witnessed, that has cause a level of distress which requires outside intervention to come in. And that's where sometimes we would come in my team. We often go in at least in pairs, and we provide spaces to talk for some of the school staff to kind of unpick, but also I guess take a deeper dive into not as well as the incident that's happened, the feelings that it might have brought on and how it's impacting the work or how it's impacting the child's day, the children's day-to-day ability to get back into a routine. So that's another type of, I'd say that's quite a niche piece of work that we do as educational psychologists.
It is.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting because I know in the area that I've worked in, we've had, a few, as you said, critical incidents, but I wasn't aware that that Ed Sykes would be involved, a part of the team, you know, involved with that. So earlier, Jason mentioned about reports being, you know, part of the key things that Ed Sykes do on their day-to-day. And, you know, similarly with me and within the role that that I do in the local authority that I work in, you know, I do reports as well. And I'm always conscious of the weight of my words and the weight that my report has when, you know, I'm sharing, you know, assessments or reports or feedback, you know, in sort of multi-agency meetings or with schools or with parents, etc. And, you know, I've even, you know, worked with schools where a member of SLT will say, well, you know, this is what the Ed Psych, you know, recommended, and they're literally putting their life and soul into that. How do you sort of manage knowing the weight of your words and the impact that it, you know, it has on the children and the families that, that you're working with?
That's a really good question. I'd say, like, on one of the key, like, skills you have to embody as being a psychologist is about being reflexive. So I think constantly being curious about your work down to the words that you use and the impact it may have. And in my practice, I do like to, when I've written up a report or some form of written record of my involvement with a young person, is to have a feedback meeting where we discuss. So a parent and school staff will get an opportunity beforehand to have a look at that report. And if there are any points in that report that they're not sure about or don't sit well with them, feel like they can bring it to that feedback meeting for us to discuss. So whether it's for me to bring life to what do these words mean in my view, or do we need to reconsider how those words have been put down. But another thing I also say is in supervision, being able to access supervision with another member of staff who is somewhat senior to you, to bring your report writing, to bring your formulation. So to bring, these are my thoughts on what I think is going on for this young person or the underlying needs, you know, how does this sound to you? Or this is the evidence that I have. So again, like being curious, but being collaborative. So recognizing that I'll have my own biases and there may be blind spots that I don't see. So being able to reach out in supervision is a way to open my perspective to what could be going on for that young person, but and also being responsive. So in situations where a parent may not speak English as their first language or have English as an additional language, do we need to have a translator or interpreter in to support with dissecting the meaning of words? Because different languages have different ways of explaining different terms. And some, for some terms, like autism, for example, there isn't a translation for that in some languages. So I think it's really important to make sure that there's a shared understanding and it's accessible to everybody who's in the room, no matter what the need is.
Yeah, that is so interesting, you know, like there isn't a translation for autism in certain languages. So it's essentially, you know, we will work with families and communities who are here in the UK, and, you know, we're throwing these words at them, you know, autism, ADHD and whatever else, and they have no meaning or understanding of it. And I'm thinking now, maybe is that the reason why so many parents that I've worked with in the past are perhaps defensive of those terms, because it's not a term that they're used to. And all of a sudden, you know, they're here and, you know, you've got these professionals who they feel are trying to dictate to them what their child is or what their child is, you know, is going through. So that's very, Yeah, that's very interesting.
I think it is very interesting. And actually, it's in the wrong hands. Those kind of ways in which terminology gets banded around can be entirely alienating to families, young people, the community, whereby it just feels like jargon. Like, what does this even mean? Mm. Why are you using it in the context of my child? What do you mean it's uncurable? Mm. Like, so much of the connotations and associations that one might make when you say your child has this, not that you would use that language, but previously that language has been used, would strike fear into any parent who's trying to not understand their child on a level. And so I think often one of the jobs of an EP and any professional who's working with children who may receive diagnostic labels in different ways is to speak to the experience of that child. So what does little Timmy do that makes you worried? Like, what are your concerns? What is brought to your attention? Like, why is this different from what you expect? Mm. So if you take it out of the context of the terminology, you can still help a parent to access the experience of their child without using language that evokes fear. And I think, like, that's a really important part of the job, is making things accessible, which is why those feedback meetings that you speak to about, Shyla, are really important. Like, your report shouldn't be another piece of documentation that a family holds but doesn't own, they have no accountability over. Again, I speak about collaboration and partnership. Like, if they can bring in, like, okay, you've got these outcomes for, like, phonics and learning certain keywords, but I really just want them to be able to communicate, I love you. Like, so many parents whose children are either nonverbal or haven't got the concept of language in a way that we would expect them to at the age that they're at, that's a big target for them. It's massively important. So just being aware of your report's audience is massively important.
Yeah.
There's multiple people who will read your report, including other professionals. Some of them are more medically based, so clinically based. Mm. So they're thinking, oh, well, like, where is the terminology? That's a shared language that I'm used to, and it helps me to know what we're talking about. So if you use lots of descriptives or speak to the experience of the child, there's a balancing to be done, and it's a very sensitive process, which is why it can take so long.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you highlighted a key point as well about collaboration. And that's why, you know, whenever I work with the children, the families that I work with, even with the schools, you know, I want the pupil voice.
Mm.
What's the young person feeling? What are they going through? What's the parent feeling? What is the parent going through?
Mm-hmm.
What is the class teacher feeling? Mm-hmm. I don't need the member of SLT. I don't need the member of...
Yeah.
I don't need the head teacher who's always having to have, you know, the kid withdrawn from class and in their office. But what is, you know, the teacher seeing and experiencing? And I think we need more of that collaboration within meetings and within... The reports as well.
Yeah.
You know, I can read a report and know who's written this and their intention behind the way, you know, they've written certain things as well. So I think that's very important. And I know that the role that you both do, there's a lot of energy that's given into the role. There's a lot of emotional labour because the young people and by extension, the families that we work with, there are many families with, you know, trauma and things that they have experienced and, you know, that they have been through and some who are currently going through these traumas. How do you stay motivated? How do you stay passionate, you know, within your role, considering all the emotional labour that you have to sort of take in?
Good question. You want to go?
Well, I was going to pick up on the point you made earlier, Shyla, about supervision. So I guess for those who don't know, supervision, in its simplest terms, is kind of like workplace therapy. I don't want to call it that, but I think that helps people to understand it, in that you're getting support to sit in a reflect, like you said, sit in a reflective space and I guess process some of the ways in which vicariously trauma from others that you're hearing day to day can impact you on a personal, emotional level from a trained other. So that supervision is a really important tool that we use to remain healthy and keep boundaries. That's really important, but also to kind of consider our implicit biases, like ways in which we may lean towards particular ideas that we've married us in our heads. So you're having to really remain curious, and that can't be done in isolation. I think often different workforces can work in silo, and it doesn't help you to remain curious because you get into a pattern of behavior, a pattern of interaction. Yeah. And you're, I know this kid, I've seen 10 of you before. You know, you haven't. And what's their story? And so let's explore that with them in a, again, collaborative way. So your question about motivation and passion, I think it takes a certain kind of person to enter into psychology in the first place. Mm. And you know, speaking as a black male, I think it's really important to consider. I don't see a lot of black men in the profession, and I'm curious about why that is. I have my own theories, but some of it is around what people say about your sensitivity or your attachment to your emotions, your connection, your emotional literacy. I think some of the ideas around what it means to be masculine sit at odds with how people have conceptualized caring professions. Mm. You know, male nurses get laughed at sometimes in that same way. And so I guess one of my motivations is to continue to do what I'm doing in the hope that other black men say, all right, okay, I can see why the profession, all the critical thought, all the ways of being reflective, the skill set you gain from doing a doctorate, Yeah, I guess the intellectuality of it all for me is super interesting. Like I'm never bored. I'm always excited by the idea of, oh, what does that mean? What's underlying that? Yeah. Even with friends and family, to their dismay, like they don't like it. But yeah. I can't help it. I love the idea of like unpacking something and like with people that know you and care about you, you will find those connections where they're like, oh yeah, You're deep, like, and I think I value that. So for me, motivation and passion is, it has to be intrinsic. It has to be from you, and then if your person, who you are, links nicely with the profession you've chosen, then your quiz is in. Like, you're already halfway there. Yeah, that's just me anyway. I don't know about you, Shaila.
Yeah, I would agree. And as you spoke about internal, I thought when I think about motivation, I think about, you know, you've got your internal motivators, your external motivators. Mm. You could think about external motivators like pay. I doubt that's the reason why proficient psychologists like primarily get into the role.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great bonus and reward to have. But for me, the internal motivation that keeps me going is to think about my why, to keep going back to my why. Like, why did I want to get into this profession? Like, what do I want to be able to achieve? I think about my own childhood experiences, how I was quite academic, but probably had like underlying struggles. And having my own, I think, I guess, like the way that I bounced back from difficulties and my own resilience was admirable upon reflection, but that doesn't take away that it was still challenging. Mm. So I think my why is thinking about future generations and thinking that I want every young person to feel like they can come up against any difficulty, be able to ask for help, and that's normal. Mm. And you spoke about feelings as well, like you're speaking about feelings a lot, and I feel like not to ignore those feelings, like those feelings that we all experience, to normalize them and use them as data, especially for young people, like when they can't make sense of their feelings, just being able to like express as a first step to acknowledge and be aware of their feelings, and then be able to like define this is what this kind of feeling is, and this is why it might be coming up, and this is how we can use it. Sometimes we need, you know, to have a bit of anxiety to get through the test, but you know, too much anxiety might stunt us from actually showing our capabilities. Yeah. So I go back to just having a why that's so big or so strong that in the times of report writing, when it does feel like it's getting on top, you can go back to, you know, what difference you want to make, and you know where you're coming from and how you want to make a positive change. That will keeps me going. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. And you both spoke about how challenging the journey and training was for you both, and at the end of it, how proud you guys were of having, you know, gone through that process. For anyone, you know, in our audience who's either at university studying or thinking about, you know, becoming an educational psychologist. What challenges, what are some of the main challenges that you experience during, you know, the sort of early days and studying, etc.? And what advice would, you know, you give them in hindsight about how to overcome those challenges?
Challenges, I'd say the doctorate so far must have been, is the most challenging, a positively challenging experience I've had in my whole life. Not only has it, obviously it's designed to grow you professionally, but the place in which I trained is very focused on or values growing you personally. So my advice, as much as my learnings are, would be like to think about yourself as a person. So prior to getting on the course, and I think this is part of the destiny in terms of me not getting on the first time, second time, is I spent some time developing myself as a person, like personal development seminars, and really unpicking like who am I as a person? What are my own barriers? What limiting beliefs do I have, and how do they get in the way? But also, what are my strong points? So, because you're going into a profession, you're going to be working with people, and you're going to encounter things that may trigger you, or things that you may be struck by, and there's going to be always going to be reasonings behind that. I'd also say, as the psychology profession is predominantly like white middle class women, for people that may be coming from underrepresented backgrounds, and thinking, you know, am I going to be able to get on the course, using that difference as a superpower, or using that as part of your almost like proclamation to say, like, I want to be part of being a diverse in a diverse profession that is, you know, serving a diverse community in which we live in.
Yeah.
And another thing I say in terms of like thinking about diversity and inclusion personally for me. So one of the pivotal points I had in my second year of study is that I discovered that I was dyslexic. So thinking about the intersectionality of being a black woman, and then having a neurodivergent condition, that completely blew my mind, but at the same time liberated me, because it wasn't something that I would necessarily anticipate in, but something that, as I guess, given me even more passion and empathy towards the children and young people that may be having difficulties in their learning. Some of those that are aware and some of those that are not aware. So not being put off by, if you are having a struggle, that it doesn't mean that you're capable enough. It's about actually trying to find the right types of support and ways that things can be adapted to lean on your strengths. One of them I know being like being relational, for example, or being really attuned, or being able to problem solve. So that was, there's a few things that I would name or encourage, and encourage people
How did that come about, you finding out you were dyslexic?
So that could be a whole other podcast in itself, but in summary, I just wanted, I remember just being on the course and finding it so challenging, like everyone does, like, and just wanting it like a little bit more support and a little bit more direction in terms of like, how can I get over the challenge of like, for example, you have to do a lot of reading. And I would find like, I'd get the reading list and I'd like try and do all the main bits of reading, and I'd get into a seminar and I'd be like, I've forgotten the majority of what I've read. And then it could look as though I haven't read, for example. But what I realized is that maybe the amount that I was reading and the ways that I was reading were not supportive to me being able to show that ability. I always knew that I struggled with like memory, for example. Very strong visually. So I have a very strong visual memory. But for some written and spoken language, I can struggle if I don't make a note. So does this little, I guess that goes back to kind of personal development, like knowing about myself, and then being able to say to my university, look, like I'm struggling with these few things. I'm just wondering what advice you might have. And that's kind of where it started. So another point of advice, if someone is feeling like they're struggling with certain aspects of their learning, being able to like define and clarify, know for yourself, this is what I struggle with, is a first step, and being able to take it to some form of learning support to hopefully unpick it. And from there, I completed some screeners and then eventually had an actual formal diagnostic assessment and discovered, that I am dyslexic. So that's a little bit.
I just find it interesting that you found out when you was doing the doctorate and not when you was actually at uni
or school or college, the whole education system.
You're doing enjoyment at uni and college, then
it means I was working really hard.
You was working really
hard. I was working extremely hard. So one of the, I guess in terms of my understanding of my profile is that, like, the level at which I work or the amount of effort at which I to which I put in is much more than that what is expected to what I produce. Some people use a spoon analogy, for example. So let's say we all have 3 spoons for the day. Yeah. By the end of the day, you might have a certain amount of spoons left, you might have a certain amount of spoons left. I may have none, but we've all done the same thing. So the amount that it's taken me to get through the day is like a representation of how much effort. So yes, I was enjoying myself in uni, but I was also working really hard. And when you get to doctorate level, that's where a lot of people, to be fair, in their adult education can find that they become aware that they have a learning difference or a specific difficulty, which they were able to mask and get through in other stages of their education.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing that. That was very helpful. I know within the education system, obviously systemic racism is something that we always have to deal with in various aspects. And I wanted to know what's been your experience of sort of navigating systemic racism within, you know, your fields, whether it's through the training or whether it's through your current roles as educational psychologists, and how have you addressed that?
Yeah.
That's big.
Yeah, it's a big question. And it touches different parts of my life, so I'll try and be concise. But yeah, it's a really important question as well, I suppose. For me, I was always aware of the stats. You know, they talk about Caribbean boys being more excluded than most groups, doing poorly on academics than most groups. And just generally how certain intersecting identities didn't perform well for different reasons, like overrepresentation in special educational need, PRUs, all that kind of talk. And so I guess I was very mindful of what it means to be working in a profession where previously, I mean, we talked about standardized assessment at some points, but there's a conversation about educational psychologists used to support this idea of like there is one intellectual way of You can gauge intellect in one way. There's a framework for understanding it, and we can rank people based off of that. And then we can, based on those numbers that we assign to people, determine if someone is performing worse than they should be based on outdated and poorly formulated, poorly designed assessment measures. This is back in the day. And so that would support these ideas around people being subhuman, subnormal, and reinforcing ideas around white supremacy, and just generally that certain ethnic groups couldn't achieve academically the same level as their white counterparts. So, I mean, that's the history of the profession. And stepping into it as an EP myself, I was kind of left with these ideas of like, I don't want to be a part of that. How is my legacy going to look different? And so when I speak about systemic racism, I think about ideas around what does it mean to challenge a school where there is continued practices around exclusions of particular groups and the school hasn't recognized or identified that themselves? Like what's going on for that school where there's a blind spot or a conscious ignoring, avoidance of conversations around adultification, of other ways in which oppression can play a role in the dynamics of teaching and learning. And so I think being both reflective as a practitioner, knowing yourself, but also be given the status and title of being an EP going to a school, as you said earlier, the EP's report, and it's like almost like gospel. You then have a platform with which you can affect change, not just for send provision in schools generally, but also social justice. And that the two for me go hand in hand. You can't ignore the ideas of certain groups being underrepresented and then just, you know, put it all down to a within child deficit issue. There needs to be a consideration around the wider aspects of how we're judging children. A good example is COVID. Like, because exams weren't able to be sat, a lot of the emphasis moved to teachers making judgments based on predicted grades or coursework or other pieces of work that children and young people had done. And my understanding, please, I'm happy to be corrected, but my understanding is that you know, black and ethnic minority children did worse based off of teachers' judgments during that period, which would have had a knock-on effect on their ability to gain entry to a university and so on and so forth. So, yeah, the problem's huge. And I guess, yeah, even if I look down the line, systemic racism isn't just an education issue, is it? It's like it goes deeper and it's more broad than that. I know from my personal experience that my mum, she was a black female engineer. So, Shyla, you talk about the intersections of identity. She was in a white male-dominated profession, and she had to take her employer to court twice for what was her understanding was prejudice around her race and sex. And so if that's the context in which I've grown up in, and I'm recognising that even though my mum is saying, be a professional, get your education, do well, she herself did that and is still receiving the consequences of oppressive practices, then it is generational and it's nuanced and it's hard to spot sometimes. But I guess that's why we do the work we do. I will quickly add about two groups that I feel are doing great work in the area. So one of them is called TEPIC, which stands for Training Educational Psychologists Initiative for Cultural Change, and the BIP Network, which is Black and Minority Ethnics in Psychology and Psychiatry. And both of those groups are working towards thinking around how the face of the profession needs to be better representative of the communities that it serves. Because not just who invented these theories, like old white middle-aged gentlemen who have long since passed and their legacies remain, but like how we apply these things all needs to be culturally revamped and considered in the context of the modern day and the communities in which they're actually being applied. So yeah, it's very nuanced and we could talk about it for hours, but those are some of the ideas in my head about how we can begin to start thinking about the far-reaching and insidious nature of systemic racism.
That's a very major question. I would add, picking up on what you were saying earlier, Yannick, around the child and young person voice, and part of my role as an EP to conduct research, my thesis was around exploring black boys' experiences of school exclusion. And I think it's a long-standing issue that, you know, statistics will show you that, as you said, certain demographics may be more likely to, one, experience exclusion, but then also be sent to a form of alternative provision, like a pupil referral unit. But I find what's missing from the research is their voices, their version of the story, their interpretation of what's happened, how it's made them feel, and the impacts of them in the short term and the long term. And I think the system can almost drown out their voices. So I think part of addressing some systemic racism is being able to get to the heart of, you know, where the individuals are, and be able to, well, my hope is to be able to advocate for their voices and put them on the map so that as a system we can continue to keep thinking about how we better support them and don't disadvantage them.
No, thank you for sharing. And you mentioned your thesis and you had a significant contributor to your thesis. Do you want to acknowledge them whilst we're on this platform?
Yeah, I want to thank you, Yannick, for being a significant contributor and
I never knew.
Supporting me to recruit the young males. That was probably one of the trickiest parts of the process, but you were very...
Was that in your acknowledgements? You said that...
That was, if you've managed to skim it, the massive document, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
There is mention.
Just checking the credits.
Making sure I'm in the credits. Yeah.
Is due, yeah.
Exactly, that's amazing. just to finish off, I want to speak about, you know, the legacy that you guys are leaving behind. I think one of the main things in why, you know, I do this podcast, why I've created this platform and why I have the guests that I have on and we discuss, you know, all of these, you know, key aspects and all of these key things which, you know, intersect with education at various levels, is because it's, you know, something that I'm very, very passionate about.
Mm.
You know, I'm passionate about education. I'm passionate about, you know, our children and our young people. And I always try to think about, you know, what's the sort of legacy, you know, I can leave behind. And I'll just give, you know, two examples. I was speaking to, this was maybe 2 months ago, I was speaking to a head teacher in a local authority that I'm working in. And we were talking about a complex case that we have at the school. And the head teacher referenced one of the episodes.
That's awesome. That I've from
the podcast and was like, oh, you know, like, you know, that episode that you had on with the boys and you was talking about, you know, trauma of like the parents. And I was just like, wow, that's crazy.
The influence.
And, yeah. You know, I think this was maybe like last week I got in touch with some of my former students because I said to them, how far behind are they? I think they left about 3 years ago. So they're in year 13 now.
Okay.
So I want to do an episode like around like A-levels and like the difference between like GCSEs and like the prepping for uni and whatever else. But rather than have adults speak about it who went to school, you know, a million years ago, like, let me just get, you know, some of my ex-students who are actually living that experience.
Absolutely.
Right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got in touch with a few of them and they were like, yeah, no, like, yeah, like, we'll be up for it. Like, you know, me and the boys have been, like, listening to that, to the podcast and whatever else. And I'm just like, yeah, you know what? Mm. Like, that's amazing. This is the legacy that, you know, I want to leave, is that I'm being very intentional. I'm creating this space where we can like educate each other.
Mm.
Like when I come on the platform and I have these discussions, often you hear me saying, oh, like I didn't, you know, I didn't know about the 0 to 25.
Mm.
Or actually that thing that you said about autism not being translated in other languages, like you're learning these things.
Yeah.
And if we're having other professionals who are listening to, you know, the podcast and whatever else, engaging with this, they're going to be saying, actually, do you know what? That's right. Like, I need to take that and I need to better myself as a professional, or better myself as a senior leader, or better myself as, you know, a head teacher. So that's, you know, me and the legacy that, you know, I'm trying to leave. And I wanted to ask, you know, for you guys, like, what's the legacy that you're trying to leave? You know, you're 4 or 5 years into the game, you're 4 or 5 months, you know, into the game. What is it that you guys want to leave behind in the sort of space of educational psychology?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, yeah, I guess for me, I'm really keen to think about legacy in a profound way. So first of all, in saying about your legacy, I really appreciate the platform that you've afforded me and Shaila. So just to be a part of that feels like in of itself change making. So that's awesome. Like, thank you very much. And I guess for myself, I think a lot about what it means to be doing it. Like, I'm actually doing it. I've dreamt of being a doctor for a long time, and I'm actually doing it. So it's like, you know, you do your 5-year plan and you get to the 5th year, you're like, okay, now what? Like, I've not got another 5-year plan yet, but that's kind of exciting for me. And one of the things that I'm keen to do with anything that I do in this profession is build space for others to come up behind me. And I guess those two organizations I mentioned is part of that approach, where I think, what is it that I needed that I didn't have when I was coming up?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a good friend of mine and colleague, she uses this term, you gotta lift as you climb. And I feel like that's so important, that we recognize the barriers that faced us don't need have to be the barriers that face the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So any legacy should include a spearheading and a pioneering of space for others to walk in your shoes and to experience those experiences. But I guess deeper than that, you know, I've got kids of my own, and they get bored with how much I talk about psychology. Like, I showed them my thesis and they're like, how many pages? Like, to them it's boring and daddy stuff. But at one day, the psychoeducation, the knowledge, the theories, the ideas, I will continue to like slowly pull out the seed, because I feel like it's like Kobe and his daughter. Like, he was giving her the basketball skills from when she was young so that she didn't have to make the same mistakes that he did. Like, psychology is a vehicle for change. And if I can impart that into my family, my community, my network, then I'm already doing good. Like, I haven't got to have this vast internationally reaching platform or network. I can affect change on my domain, and I want everyone to believe that. That's the empowerment that I've felt from people who have lifted me as they were climbing. And then I guess, yeah, I'm really passionate about community psychology. So for me, what that means is the idea of psychology not just being an institutional thing that happens in the four walls of a school or the four walls of a training provider, or within the team of EPs. Like, how can we make psychology accessible, give it away, break down jargon, and build self-awareness, metacognition, self-reflexivity in anyone that psychology touches? Because, yeah, it's been transformative for my life. So why wouldn't I want that for everybody else? Yeah, I could go on. But yeah, those are some of the ideas.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you.
That's really inspiring for me to just like hear and witness. And to piggyback on that, I'd say one of the sayings that stuck with me in terms of legacy is aspire to inspire before you expire. And I think that's something that I want to live by. Like, I want to be and hope to be a living, breathing inspiration for others, in the same way that I remember the first time as a child I saw my neighbor and learned that he was a psychologist, a black man, and I was so shocked. And I think back, it's kind of sad now. I look back and I was thinking, like, I didn't know that that existed. I knew that maybe there was these different professions, but to see a black man with a briefcase and a suit and know he was a psychologist, it was beyond me. And I remember the first time I saw a black woman psychologist on TV, again, I was just so shocked because it just wasn't my norm for a very young age. So to sit here and be able to say, like, I am Dr. Shyla, like, I am that psychologist that, you know, I first never knew about, and, you know, so on and so on. But I just say all that to say that I know that there'll be other young people that, or even adults that are thinking about pursuing a career. And I've been fortunate to be able to assist some people in going through the application process and saying, like, look, you've got the experience, we want to marry it to your knowledge of psychology. You can do it. So being an encouragement, and also just being able to walk into a room or into a school and be a representation, you know, for some families that may feel like they're isolated or not understood. And not saying that I have all the answers or I just automatically get it, but if that brings a sense of safety or connection, you know, to open the conversation, then I'm here for it. And the last thing I would say is I am a believer that vulnerability is a source of, I guess, a strength. So being able to be open and be transparent about what I'm going through, if it's in, for the purpose of like supervision, you know, for the benefit of self, but also it always comes back to the benefit of the child and the young people and the families that you're serving, you know, like what's getting in the way of me being able to write this report, for example, but also what superpowers, what strengths do I bring that can also help this child in this child, a young person and family. So being vulnerable, being authentically yourself, because everyone's got something to bring. And I know that the course has helped me to channel that, to bring into the profession.
100.
No, wait, that was perfect. Thank you very much, guys. So this has been the Too Cool for School podcast. Thank you very much to our guests. If you like this type of content, please subscribe to our YouTube and social media platforms, and we'll see you guys soon.